Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
JBR Capital has sponsored the Intercooler podcast for several months now. You've probably heard me talk about the company before. In that time, I've come to really understand what it is that makes JBR Capital different to other car finance companies. If I had to boil it down to one thing, I'd say it's this. Car finance is all JBR Capital does. Might sound like a minor detail, that, but in fact, it's really important. It means JBR Capital has a profound understanding of the car marketplace and of car buyers, an understanding that other finance companies could only hope to have. In fact, that very focused approach is exactly why the company was started in the first place. We recently had Darren Selig, founder of JBR Capital, on the podcast, episode 106, if you want to go back and listen. And he explained that he started the company when he realized that general finance lenders actually didn't understand cars or car buyers particularly well at all. So he spotted that gap in the market and he founded JBR Capital to fill it. So before you buy your next car, be it a supercar, sports car, classic car, a hypercar, or a luxury car, even if it's a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. And it really helps us if you tell them that the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Welcome to the Intercooler podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast, everybody, for episode 115. And also welcome back, Andrew, back from your holiday.
Yeah, I felt strangely proprietorial about this podcast, and you know, Henry's an old mate, but I wasn't entirely comfortable with him stepping into my shoes. I may have to never go on holiday again. But it went well, didn't it?
It was good. Yeah, it was good. We had a good chat. I think people like hearing from Henry, so hopefully everyone enjoyed that episode. But you're equally pleased to have Andrew back this week. I'm sure you are.
Thank you so much.
it's a busy one, Andrew. There's an awful lot to get through. We've been driving some interesting cars, not least the McLaren Artura, which you can now talk about in detail. You can tell us exactly what you think about that car. There's been some motorsport. There's been lots going on, including coming up this week, the Goodwood Festival of Speed. We're not going to preview it because that's not really what we do, but I think it's a nice opportunity to sort of talk about our cherished memories from the Festival of Speed, the highlights from over the years. I'm sure we've both got them. Let's just, for a couple of minutes, though, talk about the Canadian Grand Prix. It was a good one. It was just an interesting weekend all round. Wet qualifying, which was... I really enjoyed watching that because you could appreciate the skills of the drivers. In particular, a track like Montreal, where there was no margin for error with the walls right there. And sadly, though, sadly from the point of view of, you know, the spectators and those of us who want a championship fight, Max was pretty imperious, wasn't he?
He was imperious. You know, he put it on pole in those conditions. He led from, well, I mean, pit stops aside, he led from start to finish. And then at the end of it, where you had the Ferrari on fresh rubber, with all the DRS in the world at a circuit where DRS really works and overtaking is meant to be far easier than at many other circuits, you know, he was able to hold off Carlos. And I know that Carlos got close, but I didn't really think that Max was absolutely door handling it. I think he frankly had the situation under control from start to finish. And you're right, I think it is ominous for everybody else. I think I'm afraid we could have a very early wrap up to this season. I'm sure that Red Bull have already decided that that Perez is going to be cast absolutely in a supporting role, not that he hasn't already been doing that. Ferrari keeps on throwing it away, don't they? And from what we could see in Montreal is that even when they have a completely healthy car on young tyres, they can't quite keep up with Max, even with DRS. So, I mean, okay, it's only one circuit, but I think, these things do turn around very quickly, don't they? I mean, we all thought that Ferrari were going to run away with it after the first couple of races, and they clearly haven't. So maybe it'll all turn around again. But now the season has settled down. I think we're 9 races in, aren't we? In a 22 race season. So we're not that far. We're only a couple of races off the halfway point. That Red Bull and that driver of that Red Bull are such a complete package. Ferrari are not a complete package. And, it was great, wasn't it, to have Lewis back on the podium again. But I think even there, you have to temper that with reality. And the fact is, he was on the podium because Perez retired and because Charles had to start from the back of the grid. On pace alone, that Mercedes is fifth at best. And again, from what I understand about the design of the car and what can be done under the regs, they're not going to make that up this season. They would have started by now. I know they're fantastic at developing the car throughout the season. And, I'm not even ruling out the possibility that they might win a race or two, towards the back end. Who knows? Maybe after Red Bull have won the championship and they've started focusing on next year's cars. Who knows? But I think Lewis is, I'm afraid, out of it. I think everybody's out of it. I think it's, Red Bull are going to have to totally stuff it up for Max not to have back-to-back titles.
I think it's all but a done deal, actually. And I said on the podcast last week, it feels as though we might start seeing Red Bull turn the screw and start to dominate. And that's certainly what happened in Montreal. Sainz was able to follow closely, but it looked like he just didn't have the straight line speed. And actually, he never put Max under any real pressure, did he? He never got his nose up alongside or anything.
No. He was just always close. But there wasn't even a lunge, was there? It was just like in his head. He kind of decided that he was going to try and pressure Max into making a mistake. Well, good luck with that, because Max very, very rarely makes mistakes these days. But that he knew he didn't have. I mean, he did run the car on very high downforce. Do you remember there was somebody tweeted the difference in the rear wings between Sainz's car and Leclerc's car? And Leclerc, because he was starting at the back and had to get past people, was running the car very trimmed out. And it may be that Sainz just had too much wing on the car and just couldn't get enough straight line speed to get past the Red Bull. But as you say, Max never looked properly challenged.
Not at all. No, Red Bull is mega quick in a straight line. And so it proved. Looking forward to the British Grand Prix, though. We've had several street circuits in a row, or at least very narrow, tight circuits. Now we're going to a big, expansive one. Fast corners, wide, smooth. Be interested to see how that changes the established order, if at all. But it'd be good to see the Mercedes, just edge forward a little bit. Whether or not that's going to happen, I don't know. But I suppose we'll find out in a couple of weeks.
And also, we have all this, all this hoo-ha over the regs and porpoising and bouncing, which aren't the same thing. And whether Mercedes are trying to turn the screws on the organisers to get a competitive advantage, and using the sort of the health of their drivers as an excuse for that, or whether there really is a serious issue. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how that turns out. But I don't actually really see, Silverstone is a power and a downforce circuit, isn't it? And it seems to me that the Red Bull has plenty of both. It's funny, isn't it? Honda aren't getting anything out of this, are they? Because they were sort of like officially withdrawn from it, but actually not.
Red Bull have... They didn't win the team's championship last year.
No, they didn't.
That's a... Yeah, they may well come to regret that, and it's not the first time they've pulled out at the wrong, exactly the wrong opportunity, isn't it?
I give you 2009. Yeah,
exactly right. It's so there you go. Anytime Honda comes into the sport and then quits, just bet your house on them on the team winning the championship the next year, because it seems to go that way, doesn't it? A shame for them, actually, but yeah, that does seem like at least an equal to any other power unit in F1, definitely, the Ferrari or the Mercedes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, yeah, so we're edging towards the halfway point in the season, aren't we? And I think we are seeing things settle down. The Red Bull is now reliable, and it is clearly the gun car out there. And with Max at the wheel, it looks fairly unbeatable at the moment. All right, let's clip along a little bit. McLaren Arturas, so the embargo lifted last week. So this is our first opportunity on the podcast for us to talk about the car. You've written a full-length piece, a really lovely 2,000-word piece for the Intercooler app. If you haven't read it yet and you're a subscriber, go and read it now. But we can talk about it in detail here. First thing to say is you didn't do the media launch in Spain with all the other journalists. Can you explain why and tell us where you did drive the car?
Yeah, I had the option. I was very lucky. I had the option of either going to Spain with everybody else or driving the car on roads I know inside out and which are relevant to most of the people that I write for and speak about these cars to. And it just struck me as being a no-brainer. The downside was I didn't get to drive it on the track. But, you know, for me, there is no substitute for driving these cars on roads, you know, under the roads, you know, and I could go around the test routes that I take, everything around. And in terms of being able to do your job, it's an absolute no-brainer. So, so I drove the car on the...
Also, those southern Spanish roads, sorry to jump in, they're very flattering, aren't they?
They can be, yeah, and that's why people go there. They go there obviously because the weather's likely to be good. But I had decent weather on the day that I drove the car, and I took it to the Welsh Mountains, which, you know, is as good a place as any on a public road, as you can get to exercise such a thing. And I spent many hours in the car and felt that I'd really got properly under its skin.
Let's just talk about one point apart from how the car drives. This is the way it looks. So this is the dawning of a new era for McLaren, isn't it?
It doesn't look like it, does it?
The first McLaren automotive car powered by anything other than a twin-turbo V8. It's a new wide-angle twin-turbo V6 with plug-in hybrid technology bolted on. But yeah, you've just said it. It doesn't look it. Is that a shame?
I think it's a missed opportunity. I actually like the way the car looks. I think if you'd never seen any previous McLaren, this is McLaren going, hey, this is our, you know, our first road car. You look at it and think, well, that's pretty cool. I think you'd be really happy with it. But I think the problem is that, you know, this is the car on which so much of McLaren's future depends. It genuinely is all new. If you talk to them about, you know, carried over bits, they start talking about, you know, switches and clips and that sort of thing. But that's it. There really is almost nothing on the car that's been on any previous McLaren. So you'd think they'd take the opportunity to make that kind of visual statement too, and say, look guys, this really is completely new. And I fear that so many people are going to look at it and think, well, you know, McLaren, hasn't it, has been accused so much over the last 10 years of just, you know, using the same ingredients and mixing them up in slightly different ways to create slightly different recipes and slightly different cars. And I think people are going to look at this and think, well, isn't this not more of the same? You know, it's still, you know, a carbon tub, you know, mid-engine, rear-drive, two-seat supercar, fine. But they could at least have, you know, have really made a point about how new that car is by making it look equally new, and they haven't. The design director, Rob Melville, who I think has done some fantastic cars over the years, this was, you know, I think his last car, and he's left the company now. I think he's, you know, he's moved on to other things after, you know, a good term in office there. But it just doesn't look like the brave new dawn that the car clearly is. It's a shame.
Mm. It is a pity. So we've already said that you weren't on the launch event, so it's not really for us to to describe what happened. But if you read some of the other reviews in the magazines, on the websites, in the videos, journalists, several journalists do refer to reliability issues. One in particular, Autocar, they spoke about a thermal incident, which I don't know if this is exactly what he's describing, but in engineering speak, a thermal incident is a fire. I mean, there have been several other reports. You didn't have any such issues, did you?
No, I didn't. I had, you know, I had no issues at all. Well, the fact that the navigation froze on me, but they told me that it would before I got in the car, and that was just a particular issue with that pre-production unit. So I don't have a problem with that. And I think we have to be really, really careful with this stuff, because we weren't there. We didn't see what happened. I haven't spoken to anybody at Autocar or McLaren about it. So, you know, I read, like anybody else who picks up a copy of Autocar and reads what they read there, that's what I know. You know, clearly, you know, something did go wrong, and it's most unfortunate, particularly with this car, which has been, as we know, you know, delayed considerably because they were worried about the quality of the cars and various aspects of its reliability. And, you know, if you're going to do that and then launch the car, it kind of has to be right, doesn't it? It kind of has to not go wrong. And it does appear, I don't know how many cars were affected. I don't know the precise nature of what happened. I don't know whether it was, you know, it could have been anything from, you know, the smell of a bit of smoke to a conflagration. I really don't, I have literally no idea. But the fact that we're even talking about it is, you know, is not good, is it?
Not when the launch was delayed by around a year. And so it's, I mean, it's got to be concerning for McLaren and for customers, but they assure us, don't they, that these issues will be put right before customer cars are delivered.
I think the point to make there is that these weren't customer cars.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can argue, and this is a point that I've made with the Lotus Emira, about the wisdom of letting journalists loose in cars that are not representative of production spec. Problems resulting, particularly for manufacturers like Lotus and McLaren, which have not always enjoyed the greatest reputations, certainly not Porsche-like reputations for quality control. You know, as I say, you can decide for yourself whether it's a good idea to let us in these cars before that, or should you delay the cars until they're absolutely production ready. But if you're going to do that, yeah, we can always flag up that these are pre-production cars. But, you know, the reader or the listener is a canny person these days. And, you know, so many times when you go, well, this was a pre-production car and we're assured this isn't going to happen on, you know, production cars, you know, the readers or the listeners go, well, they would say that, wouldn't they? It's kind of like a get-out-of-jail-free card for them. And the truth is, we don't know what we're driving. We know what we're told we're driving, and we don't know whether those issues are specific to those particular cars and because of their particular stage of manufacture. All we can do is report what we're told and then what we find, and you know, the rest is the rest. So I don't know, but it is concerning.
Okay, well, let's talk about your impressions of the car itself then. Should we get the sort of day-to-day stuff out of the way? Ingress, egress, how's the cabin? Is there any sort of real progress made around that stuff?
Yeah, well, ingress and egress. God, I sound like really down on this car, and I'm absolutely not. So please stay tuned, because you know, there's an awful lot that's good about this car. I was surprised, given this is an all-new tub, made by McLaren in Sheffield, not imported as all previous tubs were from a supplier, that it's still difficult to get out of. You know, okay, I'm not, you know, 30 years old and I weigh a bit more than 10 stone, but even so, you know, I'm not unfit. I, you know, I'm not unusually proportioned in any way. And I'm not yet incredibly elderly. And I just found it wasn't, you know, a huge issue, but you know, when you get out of the car, you know, you swing legs out of the car and then you want to push your body off so you can get out. And with your right hand, which has to do most of the lifting in a right-hand drive car, you've got the side of the tub that curves down, and there's nowhere to get a proper grip to push yourself up. So the car is more difficult to exit than I would like it to be. And it's something that we've seen in McLarens before. That said, it's incredibly easy to fall into, which is lovely. And once you're in, You know, there's so much they get right. You know, the driving position is superb. The way the pedals and the wheels are, and the feel and the shape of the wheel, it's almost complete absence of buttons. Or, you know, fantastic. Love all that. The visibility is superb. They do visibility for mid-engine cars far better than anybody else. The new instrument packs are an improvement, but they still have these spidery little letters, which, you know, I would just rather big numbers. I don't understand why they don't have big numbers. You know, if you look back, you know, if you look at a, I don't know, the rev counter from a 1970s Porsche 911, you've got big fat numbers on there, which are easily read. And you can say, why wouldn't they make this stuff, you know, as easy to read as possible? I don't know. Maybe it's got something to do with style rather than substyle. Who knows? But that's okay. And then you have an enlarged central, for want of a better, less excruciating term, infotainment screen, which again is a big step forward. But, you know, if you look at what Ferrari are doing in that area now, which is pretty amazing, again, it's good, it's better, but it's not as good as it could, or you might even say for a car that costs nearly £200,000, should be. So, yeah, I mean, it's fine. I don't think any of these things is a reason not to get the car. But again, with an all-new car, you kind of hope that they would have made greater progress in these areas than they have.
Mm. So the stuff that really matters then. Let's talk.
Yeah.
Let's talk steering, ride, handling. Then we'll come on to the powertrain.
The chassis on that car is on difficult, open, fast public roads. The chassis on that car is just superlative. Absolutely. I mean, there are times when I found myself literally laughing at how there's a particular road I use, which isn't far from where I am. And it runs parallel to a dual carriageway. And it used to be the road that people used to go through. But when they built the dual carriageway, it basically got abandoned. And the surface is a bit rubbish. And it's all crests and cambers and tricky stuff here and there. And they take every car down it. And it was absolutely unbelievable down there. What is so good about it is the way that they don't tie the car down. They don't just, you know, put rock solid springs on it. They let the car's body move, which is what gives you that feel. It gives you that sense of being in touch. But they control that movement so well. You never get any of that sort of heave or pitch or stuff that makes you feel a bit sort of. It's superbly damped. And remember, this car doesn't have that sort of clever, active, interconnected suspension system that a 720S has. It's still coil springs and all conventional stuff. And they have done a remarkable job with that. And that's even before we mentioned the steering. Unlike the way the rest of the world has got, McLaren has remained absolutely adamant that it will keep cars with hydraulic steering for as long as it possibly can. This still has hydraulic steering. And you just get a better feel for the road. And the point is, more feel is more fun. You feel more connected. But actually, it's more important than that, because what it means is more confidence. And in cars that are that fast, particularly if you're going to be driving them quickly in public, you have to be confident in driving them. And I felt incredibly relaxed and at home driving that car. You know, amazingly well rewarded, but at the same time with this sort of sense that it was pretty easy. So. And the ride is firmer than, well, it's not a replacement for the 570S, but it's, you know, that's, I suppose, the closest thing to it. It's firmer than that. McLaren say the overall spring rate is equivalent to that of about a 600LT, but you'll know, Dan, having driven 600LTs on the road, you know, they don't ride badly. This rides, you know, pretty well, certainly more than well enough to be usable every day, certainly more than well enough given the level of handling and grip that are available. So, yeah, I mean, the chassis on that car is absolutely outstanding. And I think, so one other thing that I would say is that, you know, I think probably the greatest achievement with this car is that they have, despite all the package stuff, all the hybrid stuff they've had to add to it, it's still lighter than its rivals, which don't have hybrids. You know, this is still DIN, with a 90% full fuel tank, less than a 1,500 kilo car. It's only about 30 kilos heavier than a Lotus Emira, which, if you think about the, you wow. know, the difference in performance,
yeah.
And the, you know, Emira doesn't have a hybrid, and the Emira is a Lotus, which is meant to be incredibly light. You know, one has 300 and whatever, well, maybe 400 horsepower. The other one has, you know, not far off 700 horsepower. And there's like 30 kilos between them, despite the fact that the McLaren has a hybrid system. I mean, it is absolutely astonishing. And so much of what is so good about that, how the Artura is to drive, basically comes down to that.
That is actually extraordinary. This car, the new McLaren, now has a very trick multi-link rear suspension arrangement, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. And EDIF.
And well, that's true. Yeah. So let's talk about those two things. So does this feel like a different kind of McLaren? Because it's got, and it is now a limited slip differential with electronic control, Ferrari style.
Yes.
So what kind of difference does that make? Because that is a departure for McLaren.
Yeah, it is. And it's a welcome one. I mean, you know, I think you probably know better than most that that there have been times when McLarens have been a bit spiky. You know, I know you had a particular experience in a 765LT, which, you know, I didn't have, but, you know, you and others have talked about that. I drove the car only on the road. I didn't drive it on the track. So there's an entire sort of dimension of, you know, skids and everything else, which I didn't get into. What I can tell you is the traction is absolutely unbelievable in the car, that it exhibits almost zero turn in understeer. And the way the EDIF works, which is why it's so clever, is it's basically open, isn't it, on turning. So you don't get that thing that you get, which the Emira has, which has a mechanical differential, which just pushes the car into understeer on turning. So it keeps the diff open, so you just get into the corner really well. And then when you need it, when you come back on the power, it starts locking up. And you get this cork out of a bottle effect coming from, you know, apex to exit. So the traction is fantastic. The balance is fantastic. I mean, at road speeds, you know, all McLarens are so capable that, you know, it's quite difficult to talk about, you know, on the limit, because the limit is so far away. It's, you know, it's quite difficult to find a lot of the time. What I would say is that in terms of traction and in terms of confidence, it's as good as any car like that I've driven.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting. Okay, and powertrain. So it's got this new wide angle V6. So it's almost like a flat six, isn't it? It's so wide.
120 degrees.
Yeah. Two turbos in the V with the hybrid assistance. So,
yeah.
What do you think? Is it better? Is it progress over the old V8?
I think it's better in every way. Fine. It weighs the hybrid system. Obviously, the 3-litre V6 weighs less than a 4-litre V8 or a 3.8-litre V8. But the hybrid system adds 130 kilograms of mass to the car. That's 88 kilograms of battery, 15 kilograms of electric motor. It's an electric motor giving nearly 100 horsepower, which only weighs 15 kilograms. I can struggle to get my head around that. And the rest of the mass is just all the gubbins and stuff that you need to put it in. So there is that. I think it's better in every way. And let me just explain a few of those ways. Obviously, there is the fact that it'll go, whatever, it'll 18, 19 miles on electricity alone, which has a purpose. And, you know, you can plug it in from the mains and, you know, all the obvious stuff. Of far more importance to me is the fact that the hybrid system allows this car to generate maximum torque at 2,250 revs. Yeah? The V8, 5,000 revs.
Was it 5,000?
5,000. Okay, So at less than half the engine speed, it's already going like a complete lunatic. Yeah, that's one thing. So that peakiness that people have often referred to with that V8, it's just not there anymore. The other thing is that, you know, the turbo lag. People have spoken about, you know, the sort of slight delay between application of throttle and reaction from the engine. Well, that's gone too, because the hybrid just fills it in for you. So that is, you know, it's game-changing, really. It sounds better than the V8. It's still not a great-sounding engine, but it's got a bit of character to it. It's not just all sort of blood and thunder like the V8 was. You know, you don't need a reverse gear because it just turns the electric motor backwards and always keeps enough power in its battery to be able to do that. You know, what else? You have the, you know, you can do many more things with the various modes that you have on the car. This one has, you know, usual comfort sport track, but also an electric mode as well. Weight aside, and I suppose people would be saying, oh, yes, if it weren't for the hybrid, it would be whatever it would be. It would be a sort of 1350 kilo car or dry, a 1250 kilo car. But, you know, I guess another point with the hybrid is, you remember with their first hybrid, the P1, what their only aim with that, their best hope was that in terms of power to weight, the hybrid would be neutral, i.e. its additional weight would be offset exactly by the additional power that it brought. And that's what they achieved. The P1's power to weight ratio doesn't change if you remove the hybrid system. In the Artura, it does. The hybrid is actually net positive to power to weight ratio. So, you know, I guess that's progress. I struggle to see the downside of it. I mean, obviously, from a sort of CO2 and a taxation point of view, I'm sure that there are advantage to be had there. It's a win-win. And, you know, although I fundamentally don't quite like the idea of, you know, downsizing and fewer cylinders and everything else, in this particular example, in this case, it just works. It just really, really works. And, you know, and I think that, you know, a little company like McLaren, without some massive, you know, OEM automotive conglomerate behind it, creating this brand new 120 degree V6 hybrid twin turbo motor from scratch, and making it that good, you know, fair play to them.
It does sound like an impressive bit of kit, I have to say. Overall, you do seem very impressed by it. You gave it a 9 out of 10.
Yeah, overall, I am impressed by it. It's, you know, there's nothing else like it. Okay, yeah, there's a 296 GTB, which obviously also has a hybridized, you know, plug-in 3-liter twin turbo V6 motor, but it's so much more expensive. And it's much more powerful. I mean, in both in terms of power and price, it's much more closely aligned to a 720S McLaren. And the 720S is going to get quite a substantial power hike quite shortly. So it's a bit of a red herring. So in terms of its price point, and, you know, we think of the rivals like the MC20 Maserati, the Lamborghini Huracan Evo and the Ferrari F8 Tributo, there's nothing else like it out there at the moment. As we've discussed at length, it's a car which has its flaws, which has its problems. You know, I hope the stories from the launch don't poison people's view of the car. I don't think they will. I think possibly a bigger fear is that people will look at it and conclude that it's, you know, is not as changed as it is. Although even there, I think that, you know, were this a, you know, a mainstream car, that would be a real issue. But I think that people who are interested in buying a McLaren will do their research and they will realise that it is a new car. And maybe they will fear that the neighbours won't realise it's a new car, I don't know. But, you know, despite its obvious flaws, and my eyes are wide open to those, you know, I think they have done an extraordinary job with it. I think with the powertrain and with the chassis, and the fact that there's nothing else like it out there at its price point, I think, you know, it's an amazing car. I think they've done an incredible job, and I hope it succeeds. I want these guys to do well. So, you know, fingers crossed that it will.
So it seems to me that you think the Artura is a net better car for having the hybrid tech on it.
Absolutely. And there was a time when I never thought I'd say that about it. But it is. It is just a better car because there hasn't been an enormous, you know, the fact that, you know, why wouldn't it be? Well, the only reason really that it wouldn't be is if the car just turned into this elephant as a result. And it hasn't. It's still lighter than anything else. It's still lighter than every car without a hybrid system. So, you know, that is not, you know, the big downside that's, you'd expect. Also, you know, okay, you might think a downsized engine with smaller cylinder with fewer cylinders isn't going to sound as good. Well, I actually think it sounds better than the V8. And in all other regards, of course, it's a benefit. It's a benefit, well, in all the ways that we've gone into. So, yes, in this particular example, I would absolutely say that the car benefits from being a hybrid, which is pretty impressive, really.
I think we're well into the plug-in hybrid age, aren't we? And we know they're going to live on a bit longer than purely petrol or diesel-powered cars, at least for a few years. But I am now convinced of them. You know, I've just spent a weekend in a Porsche Panamera 4 e-hybrid, Sport Turismo Platinum Edition, long old name. And so this is the plug-in hybrid version, not the really stupid Turbo S e-hybrid with 700 horsepower. This is a 95 grand car, spec'd up to 102,000. It's got a 2.9-litre turbocharged V6 with 462 horsepower, a good chunk of that coming from the electric motor. Porsche says 34 miles on electric only, probably 25. You might nudge 30 in the real world, but, you know, certainly a good usable amount of electric range. And of course, what it also does is improves fuel efficiency in normal driving, improves performance. This thing tanks along, 460 horsepower is still a bloody lot. In a car like that, I don't particularly mind the extra weight of the hybrid. You know, it's a big, heavy car anyway. And they do amazing things with that amount of weight. It's 2.2 tons, a bit over, but it still drives brilliantly. It's comfortable. It's refined. I borrowed it for the weekend for a camping trip, and three of us piled in with a load of camping gear down to Cornwall. And it was just fantastic, comfy, pretty spacious. Although, you know, this is the Sport Turismo, essentially the estate one. We had to have some of our kit in the cabin rather than the boot because that was so stuffed full of camping gear. But it was just brilliant. And, you know, it would do an easy 30 miles per gallon. I think on a sort of steady motorway run, it would do more. But I am sold, I have to say, on being able to plug it in at home, which I can do now, or at least I would be able to if I had a charge point here, but at least I've got a driveway. And having 25 miles or so purely on electric, that's most of your local journeys, isn't it? That's driving through town, zero emissions. I just think that really works, particularly for a bigger car like that.
Well, I mean, it's a you make a very good point about the bigger car and not minding about the weight. Because, I mean, I've got a, lucky old me, I've got a Mercedes S580e here at the moment, which has a 3-litre straight six engine in it. But because it's got a pretty massive hybrid driver tractor attached to it, it's got over 500 horsepower. But here's the thing. When I charge it up, I get into it in the morning, it's giving me an electric range of 68 miles.
Yeah. That's really, you know, good, isn't it?
Well, I mean, okay, so on the current tank, okay, you know, well, first of all, the range is extraordinary. I mean, I've done nearly 800 miles since I was last in a petrol station.
Wow.
Because so much of those miles are done under electricity. And it's doing about 54, 55 for the gallon. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Wow.
This is a petrol-powered, massive 2.2-ton, you know, long limousine. Now, of course, you've got to pay for the electricity that you put in that too. But if you charge it from home, which I do, even now, the cost of that electricity compared to a fuel or even electricity you buy in a service station is buttons. It's really, so, you know, when this thing turned up, I was kind of a bit worried about running it because of the costs and thinking, oh, God, I wish it was a diesel and everything else. But actually now, using it and knowing how many of the hundreds of miles I do in it are done on electric power alone. And I love it when it's electric in it because the car is so quiet. You know, that kind of plug-in hybrid where you've got an enormous range. You know, I can get halfway to London on electricity and I live in Wales. It's amazing. And, you know, I genuinely think that for people who, you know, do long distances, you know, and for taxation reasons and everything else and don't like petrol stations and, you know, and also just don't like burning huge amounts of fuel, I really, really think that there's a role for those sorts of cars. But it's the point you made. It's the fact you don't mind the extra weight because it's not in a kind of car that's going to be adversely affected by it.
Yeah. And somehow the Panamera is still really well controlled and it still drives really brilliantly when you clip along in it. Yeah, so you're getting amazing MPG out of that Mercedes. Yeah, I mean, these are expensive cars. They're well out of my price range, you know.
Yeah, mine too.
But if I was in that market, I'd be looking at a Fev nowadays, particularly if I could charge regularly at home, which is absolutely what you have to do with these cars for them to make any kind of sense.
Yeah. And if you're charging a FEV on a motorway, you're doing something wrong.
Yeah, and I do worry about how many of these cars are actually charged. Hopefully more nowadays as people become a bit more savvy. But I remember, particularly when the Golf plug-in hybrid was new, or had been around for a couple of years, and dealers were reporting people returning cars after 2 years with the charge cable still wrapped up in its plastic covering. You know, they've never used it once. So that, in that sort of instance, a FEV just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It's horribly inefficient. But use them properly and they're brilliant.
Horribly, yeah. Absolutely.
Hire cars. You've been on holiday. I suspect this is why you want to talk hire cars.
I had a really nice holiday. I went to Corfu. A really nice holiday in all regards, save the bloody hire car. And so the only reason I want to bring this up is I just, you would have thought, given the amount of time I've spent abroad in hire cars all over the world, both for, you know, for when I've been on holiday, but actually most of the time for work, that I would have figured out how to do it. And I still end up with, this one was probably the worst car I've ever hired, because even the really, really awful cars I've hired in the past, by the time you spent a week or so in them, they've done something to you in a weird, you know, perverse, somewhat masochistic way. There's usually a little, there's something about them which, you know, finds its way under your skin. And I'm talking about, you know, a naturally aspirated diesel Toyota Corolla that I hired in Mexico once, was the slowest thing I've, can you imagine? And it was so noisy and it was so terrible. And yet, I don't know, it just kind of, I find myself mildly amused by that. I rented some ridiculous, I went to Zambia and thought I was getting a Toyota Land Cruiser, and I ended up with a completely knackered old Nissan pickup, which I drove all over the country. And even that, I kind of felt a little tinge of emotion to when it went back. But the last week I have been driving a second generation Citroen C3, and there is not one thing about that car that I liked. It didn't do anything. It didn't even do anything adequately. It wasn't even sort of a bit me. It was bad at everything. It was slow, it didn't ride, it didn't handle, it wasn't even economical. It woofed through the fuel. It was I don't mind that it was, you know, that it was cheap, but you know, this is a car which allegedly had air conditioning. Well, not that I could see. And I don't know, it's just a funny old game, isn't it? The hire car game. You always, I'm sure you're the same, you always kinda ask for, you know, and they always use Focuses and Golfs in the adverts, don't they? And then they go, this is the car you'll get, you know, brackets, all similar. And the definition of all similar is just hilarious. So this time I asked for the Focus or the Golf or whatever, and I got this knackered Citroen C3, and it was appalling. And I just wondered whether have you ever been pleasantly surprised by anything you've ever hired?
Oh, there's a question. Not pleasantly surprised, no. I mean, they've mostly been adequate. I don't think I've ever had a properly terrible experience like the one you're recounting here. Some fairly ropey things. You know, we had in Mykonos a couple of years ago, we had a Suzuki Alto with an auto. And that was fairly dreadful, but no, it got us around.
I think you're just more relaxed about these things than I am. It really matters to me. Yeah. I don't expect, you know, I don't expect to have, you know, sort of 9/11 type driving experience, but I don't want it to be nasty.
Yeah, that's understandable.
I don't want to get, every time I get in the car, think, oh God, I'd rather be on the bus. But whatever it was, you know, it could have been 10 years old. I don't know how old it was, but you know, a Citroen C3 of that age without a straight panel on it, no. Not my idea of fun, I'm afraid.
Yeah, okay. Well, I do remember a guy's holiday in LA and Vegas, and we had I don't even know what it was, some sort of MPV thing. What do they call it? I don't know, like a soccer mum car. Maybe it was a Chrysler. I can't even remember what it was. A fairly miserable machine, but because we could get four of us in it, with captain's chairs and all our stuff, we just had a brilliant time in it. You know, that was fine.
And it would have had amazing air conditioning in it, and it would have been, you know, it would have been fine.
Yeah, it was spot on. It did absolutely roast its brakes on that amazing run down into Death Valley. When you that hill that just keeps dropping down and the temperatures keep rising. I wasn't in it at the time. I was in the other car. We had a Mustang. But those guys had to stop halfway down because they just totally lost the brakes. So maybe they would have a better terrible hire car story than me just because they were in that thing at the time.
And you were swanning around in a presumably a convertible Mustang.
It was a convertible Mustang, yeah. And it did the job very well.
Please tell me it had a V8 in it.
It didn't. No. I let us down there. It was so cheap, though. You know, I don't really mind it. Yeah. It's filthy cheap. Anyway, so we're not going to do a listener question this week because we're running out of time. So I will just say thank you to JBR Capital for sponsoring the podcast. If you're looking to buy a new car or a used car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. Please rate and review the podcast. Please do also subscribe or follow wherever you get your podcasts. But before we finish, let's just rattle through a couple of Goodwood Festival of Speed memories because it's on this weekend. It is one of the highlights of the automotive year here in the UK. What stands out when you think back to all those Festival of Speeds from over the years?
Well, I mean, I could just sort of bang on about all the lovely cars I've been lucky enough to drive up there, but actually, what I like most is, and it's what is best about the festival, and don't get me wrong, I would prefer to go to the Revival than the festival, because that's proper racing, always. But you'll never find a wider range of cars anywhere in the world, from, you know, all the new launches, all the new cars, many of which have never been seen anywhere in public before, to some of the oldest things. All the road cars, all the race cars, the Formula One cars, the sports cars, the touring cars. It's just the variety and the fact that people could just go straight up to these things. And it's an incredibly, it's an amazingly democratizing place where, you know, the only qualification is you have to be an enthusiast. And that's, and you know, and if you're an enthusiast, and you can afford the entry ticket, you can, you know, you can go and walk up to, you know, the latest Ferrari Formula One cars, or basically you can think of any car from any era, from any discipline that is your thing, and you'll go and find them there. And that's what I've loved about it from, you know, from the very first. Well, I was lucky enough to be at the very first Festival of Speed in 1993. So this is the 30th. Well, it's not the 30th festival, is it? But it's the it's 30 years of the Festival of Speed, and it's I've always just been amazed by the quality of the stuff they get. There's never a sense is there that they've been resting on their laurels, that it's all got a bit easy. They're always pushing, they're always trying, they're always doing new stuff. And I think, you know, as we have seen the death, or certainly the critical endangerment of motor shows around the world, here is this, you know, garden party in the southeast of England, which just goes from strength to strength. And I wish it all the very best and hope it does so, continue to do so forever.
Yeah, I remember going, my dad took me when I must have been 15 or 16 before I could drive there myself. And it's exactly that, the access, how close you can get to everything. You know, for a car fanatic, motorsport fanatic, a through and through petrol head who had no access at that point to interesting cars, no way of getting to spend time with great cars. Here they were, within arm's reach, being absolutely flogged up the hill. The sound, the sight of them being driven on the door handles, it was absolutely fantastic. And I still get a kick out of it now. Festival of Speed, it is a special thing, isn't it?
I'll be there on Friday and Saturday, so hopefully see you down there.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Good to have you back, Andrew, and let's do it again next week.
Look forward to it.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.